The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from National Geographic. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, I want to remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we are going to visit A Fortress of Faith. That's the title of Emma Lira's article in the December 2023 issue of National Geographic. As the editors write, we gain an inside look at the fabled Alhambra, where Spain's last Muslim kingdom ruled for nearly 300 years. And I'm going to provide just a brief overview of Spain's Muslim era before we begin. It starts around AD 800 with the first crossing at Gibraltar during the Age of Andalus. That was in about 711 when General Tariq ibn Sa'id sails a Muslim army toward a rock that would later bear his name. Then around AD 900, there's a break from the Damascus Caliphate, and that leads to the Iberian Peninsula's first independent Muslim state. Now, over the next 200 years, North African Berber tribes fortify Muslim cities and strongholds against Christian advances. And around 1200 to 1238, new leaders moved the capital from Cordoba to Seville, all in Spain. This would make them closer to the ocean for better trade. And in those final years, between 1380 and 1400, in a final power split, the last Muslim dynasty founds the Kingdom of Granada, but later falls to Christian forces. Now, before we begin, I'm going to share a photo caption that's going to give you kind of an overview of what we're going to be looking at. This picture, by the way, is of the Alhambra's very elaborate cistern, and it reads, "Archaeologist Jesus Bermudez shines a light into history. The Alhambra's two great chapters, he says, owe their beginning to water, the source of life. The hilltop fortress required a complex water system. The cistern tapped with buckets through a well, which is shown in the center of the photograph, and this is a one-and-a-half-page photo, by the way. And it was built in 1494 under the city's first Christian governor, then expanded access that had begun under the Muslim dynasty. We began the article. Jesus Bermudez has deep ties to the Alhambra. Born in the fortress built on an imposing hill in Granada, Spain, he grew up within the palace's walls. When his father became director of the Alhambra Museum in mid-century, the family moved into a house inside the monument. It was the stage, in quotes, as he calls it, on which his days played out, an upbringing that steeped him in its legends and history from an early age and inspired an enduring devotion to it. For nearly four decades, Bermudez has been the archaeologist and conservator at the Alhambra, seen as the crowning glory of the nearly 800-year Muslim reign on the Iberian Peninsula. Though he moves through the complex with the easy familiarity of navigating one's own home, he still manages to impart a sense of wonder as if glimpsing it for the first time. He stops often to greet student groups, guards, guides, gardeners. He displays the same pride, I imagine, the sultans must have had when they showed their palace to visitors. Bermudez is the ideal guide for a behind-the-scenes tour and has also written the official guide. Starting from the Gate of Justice, the largest of the Alhambra's four entry points, we explore not only its trademark courtyards and towers, but also the recesses that a few are allowed to see. Now, places where fact intermingles with fable is how he describes it. As researchers continue to plumb its depths, the Alhambra remains a site for archaeology and restoration, including a rebirth of one of its most enigmatic works of art recently completed after nearly 20 years. The Alhambra is the first and foremost a Palatine city, he says. And I want to just share with you a little bit about that word Palatine. It is from medieval Latin, and it's a medieval Latin word, as a matter of fact, Palatinus, meaning possessing royal privileges. And over history, the term Palatine or Palatine has come to mean an enormous amount of power over a specific territory. We continue with the article. It was the seat of the head of state, with military barracks, a courtly city, and a set of palaces built over the course of 2.5 centuries, as he goes on to describe the Alhambra. The monument grew over that time from the primitive Akazaba, or fortress, built by Muhammad I, beginning in 1238, to later palaces reflecting the Nasrid dynasty's sumptuous style. A line of sultans from the Nasir family ruled until 1492, when this last stronghold of Muslim authority on the peninsula was toppled by a newly unified Spanish monarchy after the marriage of Isabella of Castile and Ferdinand of Aragon. During the 254 years the Nasrids governed the Granada Emirate, which extended far beyond the city itself, this part of today's Andalusia region was frozen in time, maintaining a feudal society secluded in an idyllic oasis, Bermudez explains. And yet the kingdom left a legacy and a monument considered the pinnacle of the beauty and architectural refinement born in Al-Andalus, as the larger Muslim-ruled region was known then. History will never forget it. With Granada's fall, a succession of Catholic governors ran the fortress until the beginning of the 19th century, when it was occupied by Napoleon's troops. They decimated it on their departure. The Spanish crown eventually ceded the monument to the state, and it became a national monument in 1870. Today, the Palatine city is alive again with a court of officials at its service, a bureaucracy that keeps it running, and strict entry protocols as if it were foreign envoys bearing a message for the emir. One of the most notable envoys to Spain is the reason so many know this corner of the world today. The writer Washington Irving was a diplomat posted at the American Embassy in Madrid when he visited Granada in 1829. That was 17 years after Napoleon's troops had decamped, and what remained deteriorated from neglect. Rooms were plundered, the pools became washing areas, the courtyards were turned into corrals, and families who had nowhere else to go settled into empty spaces. It went from being a castle of kings to a refuge for outcasts, but it was always inhabited, says Bermudez, and that kept it standing. The quarters of the Alhambra, Bermudez calls them. Irving gave them a more romantic name, the Children of the Alhambra. It was the vagrants, the bandits, the disinherited, who together with the ghost of the defeated populated his tales of the Alhambra, unveiling the city and putting it on the tourist map. Still in every bookstore in the city and widely translated, the book perpetuated the fortress's romantic aura, reminiscent of 1001 Nights. Other notables had set foot in Granada, but none had the impact of Irving. Given the weight of his influence, his single statue, set just off the Cuesta de Comares, a historic path to the fortress, seems like a lukewarm tribute. When Irving arrived at the Alhambra with his traveling companion, a Russian diplomat, they were appalled that visitors, even dignitaries, had left their mark in graffiti, their names and notes scrawled on its walls. The Russian provided a leather-bound guestbook to discourage the practice. Thousands of signatures filled that volume for the next 43 years. It was an early glimmer of recognition of the structure's value. Though his fellow traveler soon departed, Irving would stay on for several months, spellbound, he wrote, in this old enchanted pile. He ensconced himself in royal chambers that opened up into a picturesque Linda Raja garden. Mateo Jimenez, a self-described son of the Alhambra, who claimed his ancestors had lived in the fortress for generations, offered himself up as a servant and guide, recounting the family lore. Places where Irving set his reflections and accounts still can be seen today, such as the reconstructed gate of the seven floors. Popular legend holds that Boabdil, the last sultan, fled through that gate, imploring that it be sealed after his departure. Irving's story describes a succession of passages in which the sultan would have hidden a magnificent treasure in case he ever managed to return. Another spot, the Tower of the Princesses, later renamed after Irving's tale, was the setting for his story of three Muslim princesses who fall for Christian captives. The book made the fortress an object of desire, a need to visit it, to discover it, says Bermudez. Today we know this is also part of our heritage. Preserving a universal monument such as the Alhambra also means preserving all the values from its past. The Alhambra has always re-enraptured those from the outside. In January 1492, Queen Isabella, leading a military procession, began her triumphant ascent up the Cuesta de Gomeros on horseback to Alhambra, which translates to the red for the fortress's pink-hued stone. The reconquest, lasting more than 700 years, had rolled back Muslim territories one by one across the peninsula. A papal order authorized this final crusade, resulting in a 10-year war waged for control of the holdout Granada kingdom. When the keys to the Alhambra were finally surrendered, chroniclers noted Isabella's surprise as she took in the fine details inside the bastion that had long been forbidden to her. Its intricate latticework, honeycombed vaulting, the infinite geometry of its tiles, trickling pools that mirrored the magnificent facades. The Alhambra had been an impregnable fortress for almost three centuries. One might expect a Christian queen to reduce it to ashes, erasing from its walls the inscriptions praising Allah. Instead, she ordered that it be felt untouched. What's more, she determined it would be her destiny for eternity, something that the unfortunate Boabdil could not fulfill. I will and command that if I should die outside the city of Granada, my entire body be taken as it is without delay to the city. When she died in 1504 at her residence in the town of Medina del Campo, her coffin was sent on the three-week journey to Granada. The Alhambra, emptied of its Nazarene court just 12 years before, would be the final resting place of the Catholic queen. Initially interred in the fortress, her remains, along with those of her husband, King Ferdinand, were later transferred to the Royal Chapel of Granada. While on his honeymoon several years later, King Charles V, Isabella's grandson, visited the city conquered by his grandparents. Grasping the symbolic value, he set out to designate his own palace in the Alhambra. Now, construction took more than a century, and the king never lived there, but Bermudez considers that beside the point. It is superimposed a new narrative, he says. Charles used the original architecture as a base to build a metaphor for triumph, and, quote, placing himself just a little bit higher, Bermuda says. Standing adjacent to the three Nazarene palaces, the Mexuar, the Camarales, and the Palace of the Lions, collectively the undisputed jewel and the crown for visitors, the square, rigid structure built for the Spanish king was likened to a meteor by one architect. Inside the central colonnade of Charles' palace, Bermudez pulls out the key the size of his forearm and opens a door to a stone staircase. The stairway of time, the Alhambra staff calls it. We descend in semi-darkness to another gate. My eyes struggle to adjust before I'm dazzled by bright light. Bermudez wields a new key, as if enchanted. I'm suddenly standing in the courtyard of the myrtles, named for the bushes that surround its rectangular pool in the Camarales Palace. Yes, a bit lower than Charles. In a moment, we transition from Renaissance sobriety to a saturation of the senses, from the victors to the vanquished. The staircase, built in 1580, was intended to do precisely that, to unite the old royal house with the new one. Tourists view our sudden apparition as if we were ghosts from the past. With a mischievous smile, Bermudez closes the door behind us. Some 2 million people visit the Alhambra each year, but they're limited to about 20% of the site. Bermudez guides me through some of the hidden parts, namely an underground network. These are modest and functional rooms, he says, kept out of sight as they were back then, the domain of servants and guards who kept the palace running. Some also held prisoners. We peer into one of the complex's 20 dungeons, which was discovered just over a century ago. After the fall of Granada, the queen herself rushed to free Christian prisoners, as she had done in the Muslim stronghold of Malaga, where an officer from the Netherlands told her he'd been held for more than 40 years. Still in the bowels, we make our way to a large cistern, which more readily resembles a cathedral with its barrel-vaulted naves and sheer size. The underground structures also provided a cool, stable temperature to store grain and other staples. As we descend by ladder into a cave-like silo, it strikes me as the place where the Alhambra's legendary passageways would begin. I instinctively search with my headlamp. None are here, but they do exist. One level up, members of the Royal Guard would have been posted beneath the throne room in the Commandos Tower, ready to intervene in a crisis. We walked through the tunnels, aware that tourists marveling at the magnificence of the room cannot imagine the infrastructure that lay beneath. Bermudas unlocks a door. A flashlight illuminates a staircase that leads deep into the earth, and after 20 steps down, to yet another door. It opens into the heart of the woods just outside the walls. We're a short distance from the Dalu River. It would have been easy and clandestine way to leave the fortress. In 1359, Muhammad V, the 8th Nasrid monarch, was ousted by a revolt that put his half-brother in his place. In the middle of the night, rebels scaled the walls and knifed the guards. Barely 20 years old, the rightful sultan escaped, some say through a passageway in the Commandos Tower. Was this the place where he would have arrived breathless and been spirited away? The coup was a game of thrones involving the changing loyalties, including that of his Christian ally, Peter of Castile. And after 3 years, Muhammad V returned to his throne. Without that subsequent prosperous and peaceful 30-year reign, the Alhambra as we know it today would not exist. Muhammad ushered in the dynasty's golden age. He built what many consider to be the most striking spot in the Alhambra, the courtyard with the central fountain, ringed by a dozen lion statues, and he continued his father's tradition of embellishing palaces with another art form, Arabic inscriptions. The Alhambra is a palace of poems and architecture of words, says José Miguel Puerta Vilches, author of Reading the Alhambra, which decodes the inscriptions on its walls. Like Bermudas, he spent his life studying this place and translating it to the world. If it's lost its supports, columns, and arcades, the building would be held up by words alone, he says, referring to its ubiquitous calligraphic panels. Leaning on his knowledge, I see a different Alhambra with the language barrier, one that remains largely inaccessible to those who inherited it. Verses run along its walls, curl in cartouches, and even meet in this closet. Some are carved in plaster, others in wood, or meticulously inscribed on towels. The omnipresent motto of the Nasrid house, "There is no conqueror but God," alternates on the walls with the greetings for visitors, including Baraka, or blessing, Afia Bikaya, perpetual health, and fortune. In reality, the Alhambra was designed to praise God and the Sultan as God's earthly representative. The ornamental script envelops visitors as if they were inside a monumental book, but the power of the written word didn't end there. The Diwan al-Insa, the Office of Correspondence and Records, was created around 1273 and run by a master of two nuanced arts, diplomacy and writing. His function was propagandistic, says Puerta Vilches. The text had to be not only correct, but beautiful, poetic, capable of praising God, the dynasty, and the Sultan. The person with the best command of language, the Khatib, became a double vizier, head of all that office and prime minister, the most powerful man in the kingdom after the Sultan. Puerta Vilches regards the kingdom's great poets as if he had worked with them himself, composing verses or transcribing internal documents that serve as invaluable chronicles of a tempestuous era. In his view, it's the swan song of the dynasty. And he's aware of the geographic isolation of the peninsula and the inevitability of its fall, he says. Written mainly by three successive poets who headed the chancellery in the 14th century, the Alhambra's epigraphs represent some of the Nasrid's most dazzling contributions to Islamic art, perhaps an attempt to demonstrate a grandeur that was not going to last much longer. Of the two forms of Arabic used, the Nashki, or cursive, is easily visible, but the Kufic form may go unnoticed even by a visitor who knows the language. With a rectilinear style, it can be a masquerade as a geometric element blending into the decor. In the Palace of the Lions, poet Ibn Zamrak and Muhammad might have had their boldest collaboration. Its fountain, magnificently sculpted so that the rock grain simulates the lion's muscles, contains a symbolic message. It features the word Caliph, Islam's highest leader, whose role transcends that of Sultan. The change in the title imbued Muhammad, a political figure with religious authority, an impeccable example of 14th century PR. These were different times, or difficult times, says Puerto Fichez. The Sultan needed to legitimize his power, not to Christians so much as to his own people. The same palace also holds a rare artwork in the Hall of the Kings, which after a two-decade effort has just been restored to its former glory. Three painted scenes include human figures, atypical in Islamic art, but that's only the enigma. Presiding over the central dome, 10 men dressed in luxurious Muslim-style garb appear to be watching over the palace. Or over that particular space in the palace, I should say. One theory maintains they're the first 10 Nasrid rulers, hence the room's name. The other paintings depict medieval courts, vignettes in which Christian and Muslim knights hunt, joust, and rescue maidens. Muslims always win these scenarios. At least two royal weddings took place in the Hall of the Kings, says Puerto Vichez. These paintings extolled the splendor of the Nasrid court and were meant to be seen. The 14th century works were eventually hidden when the room was absorbed into a 16th century church, and over time, they deteriorated. The original canvases were made from horse hide, tanned with alum, and embellished with natural tempera pigments, then attached to wooden frames shaped like inverted boat hulls and covered with tar and plaster to prevent water or fire damage. Artisans from different trades were involved, specialists in woods, painting, and leather. Together, they created a masterpiece whose execution technique is unknown in the Spanish Muslim world, says Elena Correa, who heads the Alhambra's restoration department. A collection of architects, master plasterers, carpenters, and painters has worked hand-in-hand to repair the hall, presumably as the team that created this artistic jewel did 600 years ago. One achievement was inventing a restorative mortar that was imperceptible to the viewer. The stealth ingredient is quinine. If we want to show a reconstructed segment, we have to use ultraviolet light, says Ramon Rubio, who leads the stucco and tile restoration workshop. The inspiration arose from an unexpected moment when he observed quinine's fluorescence in a gin and tonic under disco lights. Who were the painters of these scenes showing the last vestige of coexistence, Muslims and Christians, before the fall of Granada? Well, experts say they could have been Christian artisans from neighboring kingdoms that commercially traded with the Emirate, mainly those on the Italian peninsula and particularly Genoa, or Muslims who knew the Renaissance techniques of those courts. Despite the arduous research involved in the restoration in this place, as so many others in the Alhambra, mysteries remain. I look over the Albaicín, Granada's labyrinthine medieval quarter built on a hill opposite the Alhambra. With its whitewashed facades, villas, and hidden gardens of cypress trees, it's hard to imagine a more perfect view. I descend toward the Albaicín, down a lane known as the Cuesta del Rey Chico, Little King Boabdil's nickname. Departing as the 24th and last Nasrid Sultan did when he left the fortress forever. Crossing into that parallel world, I see the Alhambra as his subjects might have. From the Albaicín, the Alhambra's palaces can be read chronologically from right to left, like Arabic itself. The language can still be heard in the quarter, which is lined with tea shops and has the ambiance of souk. After Boabdil was deposed, residents were allowed to keep their businesses, homes, language, and religion, but the spirit of coexistence only lasted about 8 years. By 1501, Muslims were forced to flee or convert to Christianity. I peer into the Dal Araf Palace, the home of Boabdil's mother and his final refuge in Granada. Before he fled to Morocco, nothing on the outside gives way to its graceful interior. Like the Alhambra, the exterior reveals little. Beauty is unveiled only within. Before leaving, I pause for one last look. My friend Blanca Rooney, a veteran guide, is beside me. I've seen it many times, she says. It's the look of someone who is bidding farewell to the Alhambra as if they had just been expelled from it. Quite an interesting story there, right? Well, included with Imalera's article is a small section that is titled Visiting Granada, and we're going to pick up there. The city's rich heritage offers unique experiences for visitors. First, we do have the Alhambra, which we've been discussing. Book tickets at least 1 to 2 months ahead. General admission allows access to the Alcazaba, Nasrid Palaces, the Pertal and Generalife, or General Life, as some might say. The visit is mostly outdoors, making spring and fall ideal times. Don't miss the courtyard of the Lion's Fountain and the courtyard of the Myrtles with facades reflecting its pool. And by the way, King Charles V's palace, home to two museums, may be visited without a ticket. Then we have the Monastery of San Francisco, where monarchs Isabella and Ferdinand were initially interred, and now it's a hotel and restaurant that serves cuisine based on Nasrid court recipes. Then we have the Albaicin. In this winding old quarter, once in the center of Granada's Muslim life, boutique hotels occupy villas from the Nasrid dynasty's era. Our pick is the 15th-century Hotel Casa de Marisca. An alternative to the Albaicin steep streets is the centrally located Palacio de los Petos, a 19th-century magnate's mansion. A Carmen de Abin Humea diners take in the view of the Alhambra from within its walled garden, a distinguishing feature of traditional Carmen dwellings. The San Nicolas Lookout and the adjacent Mosque Gardens are classic spots for watching the sun set over the Alhambra. But the evening with a stop for tea at the Calle de Candelaria Nueva is the best way to end the day. Now, Sacromonte. Now, nearby Sacromonte is the birthplace of flamenco, a dance created by the Romani community that settled here more than 500 years ago. Now, many live in the area's characteristic caves where Muslims took refuge after the fall of the city, and some say also influenced the music of the dance. Cave bars now host performances including Cueva de la Rocio. A scenic walk to the neighborhood passes through the El Paseo de los Tristes and the La Carrera del Darro along the river. So lots of fun there. Now I'm going to read, while time permits, a couple of captions to give us more insight about the Alhambra. This first picture looks like a giant hole in the ceiling, but it's actually a tower. A large silo, as a matter of fact, not only stored grain, but also served as a dungeon of one of 20 found in the complex that makes up the Alhambra. Captives were lowered by rope into a hole where they would await ransom or prisoner exchange. As the request of conquest by the newly unified Spanish monarchy gradually rolled back the Muslim kingdom's territory, Christian prisoners became more common, though sometimes those held here included members of the Sultan's own court. And this is quite impressive as the light comes through that hole. You can see it's at least a 20-25 foot drop. They have a ladder they've already placed in their more modern stainless steel ladder so you can go up and out and look at it. Our next photo shows two men using some handmade brooms. These guys are part of the staff that maintains the interior of the Alhambra, and they do quite a job. Some 500 people are hired to take care. And that, my friends, is about the end of today's journey, I'm afraid. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be back with us next week for another adventure on Armchair Traveler. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. Questions and comments may be directed to 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.